Along Caddo Creek, Chickasaw Nation, everything finally clicked for Jackson Six Persons, a slow, methodical man who waited until he knew everything before making a decision. It had kept him alive in Indian territory. He recalled his conversation with the Chickasaw up at Fort Arbuckle.
We will meet the Texans there. They bring us money for grass to feed their beef.
Knowing Texans, knowing how hard and dry things had been in the Lone Star State, those cattlemen would be paying a tidy sum for all that grass to feed their cows. The lease price. That was what Link McCoy and Zane Maxwell planned on stealing. Six Persons had sent Flat and Mallory to bring back more lawmen, and by a stroke of luck, he had asked for the deputy marshals to rendezvous with him at Fort Ouachita. Cherokee Marshall almost felt satisfied until he saw the dust up the trail. He reined in and motioned for the two kids, James Mann and Robin Gillette, to stay behind him. Six Persons pressed the shotgun's butt on his thigh and waited. A rider came into view, stopped, stared, and then slowed his horse to a walk, approaching slowly, carefully.
Osio!
Don't hello me in your heathen tongue.
Thought you were supposed to be in Fort Ouachita.
Was. Got told not to.
Folsom reached into his pocket and pulled out a note.
So, I get to play Pony Express Rider and deliver you some important message.
He held out the yellow telegram. The two kids, sensing the lack of danger from Folsom, eased their horses alongside the old Cherokee. Six Persons studied the telegram after adjusting his spectacles.
McCoy Maxwell gang to rob Katie at Gibson Station, July 4, stop. Proceed immediately to assist, stop. G.R. Crump, U.S. Marshal, Fort Smith.
How does Crump know the gang's robbing the train?
The telegrapher didn't tell me.
July 4th, hmm?
Yeah, you got some hard riding to do to get to Cherokee country in 6 hours.
What took you so long to deliver this?
You ain't exactly the easiest lawman to find.
That gang's nowhere near Gibson. They're robbing the Texans delivering that money to you Chickasaws today at Fort Ouachita.
That explains why the Mighty Mucks at Muskogee told me not to be there today.
I'm going. There's a mighty big reward on McCoy and Maxwell.
Yep.
Folsom nudged his horse to the side of the road, riding past the girl, walking at first.
Problem is, you can't spend that money if you're dead.
The half-breed Chickasaw left the three sitting their horses in the middle of the trail.
I'm going.
So am I.
James had already pulled the big Winchester 86 from its scabbard. Six Persons turned to the girl. She had picked up the dead Ranger's Winchester repeater and the dead outlaw's star revolver.
Can you shoot that rifle?
She shoots better than I do.
Damn, that ain't exactly the high praise I was looking for.
Fort Ouachita, Chickasaw Nation. From the high point of the road, McCoy watched. Trees grew along the creek banks and on the hills behind the fort. He saw a few tents flapping in the wind outside the fort's walls, and inside the fort, a Texas Lone Star flag flew high and proud. The Chickasaws must be welcoming those Texas cattlemen.
Locksburg!
McCoy waited for the gunman to ease his horse forward.
The guard tower's yours. Get up there. Should be two sentries. Texans. Kill them quietly.
No problem.
When you've done it, lean out the front window, wave that pretty bandana I gave you. That's our signal.
Mm-hmm.
The gunman kicked his horse into a trot and headed down the hill toward the old fort.
Red, you ride with the whiskey runner, but keep your horse tied behind the wagon.
McCoy waited as the gunman dismounted to lead his old nag to the covered wagon.
Smith, you have...
I know. You told us often enough. Upstairs corner window, the west barracks. Good cover.
That's right.
The army boys had put up those barracks back in 56, finding the limestone at a nearby quarry. Since it had been abandoned, some family had turned the big building into a home, but they were out of town, renting the place to the Texans for their celebration and party.
Then get to it!
McCoy watched John Smith lope toward the fort, then turned to Tulip Bells.
The south barracks are yours.
That building, finished around 1849, had been made of wood and stone, the lumber coming from 75 miles away. It stretched 120 feet long and 30 or so feet wide, 14-foot-high ceilings, with the upper story completely surrounded by a veranda. During the army years, the upper story had been used for two companies and the orderlies, while the company mess and storage rooms sat on the dark bottom floor. Bells would find a good vantage point from the upper story. Most of the visitors and dignitaries would be on the parade ground, what they called the Cannon Pavilion back in the day, but the cannons had left with the army. Bells grinned before kicking his horse into a trot. McCoy watched him ride away before turning his horse and moving closer to the covered wagon.
You know where you're going?
To hell. But not today.
Don't get smart, Bodine.
I follow the road right down to the spot between the old adjutant's office and the bachelor quarters for the officers, north corner, and start serving up whiskey and death.
With Red covering from those quarters, the gang would have everyone in the fort covered. They'd start shooting, killing the guards when the stagecoach arrived with the gold. During the murderous fire, McCoy and Maxwell would gallop from their spot by the old two-room log cabin, leap into the stagecoach, and drive away with the gold. The others, even poor old Tulip Bells, would have to fend for themselves.
And get moving. You ought to be serving whiskey in 15 minutes.
Zane Maxwell pulled out his watch and nodded in satisfaction at the time. He glanced back at the road.
What about Whitney? He ain't showed up yet.
The gunman had been assigned the officers' quarters along the northwestern edge of the main part of the old fort, but they could handle things without him. Most of the buildings had been abandoned since the army had left.
More money for us.
There.
Millard pointed toward the watchtower, and McCoy grinned at the sight of the lavender bandana flapping out of the center window.
He works fast, don't he?
Uh-huh.
The Indian breed eased his horse next to the wagon.
And me?
Right in with the wagon. You know the rest.
When the ruckus starts, I'm at the corral helping scatter the horses.
Right.
Time to start the ball, boys.
Maxwell and McCoy watched the wagon ease down the road with Newton Ahalo Mantubby riding alongside. They gave the wagon a head start, and then Link McCoy and Zane Maxwell kicked their horses into a slow walk, confident that in an hour they would be riding out of the Chickasaw Nation at a high lope and filthy, filthy rich. Grinning like the madman he was pretending to be, Millard Mann pointed at the Winchester rifle Red had on his lap.
That's my rifle, you know.
Not no more, it ain't.
Red flicked the lines, and the wagon picked up a little more speed.
Mine. One of 1,000. You probably figured I didn't know that.
Well, I hope you enjoy it.
Millard looked to his side where the half-breed Choctaw rode alongside the wagon on his horse.
Reckon you better get to the corral, Breed, before McCoy and Maxwell get irritated.
Uh-huh.
Newton, a hollow man tubby, kicked his horse into a lope, moving in front of the wagon, making Millard and Red eat the horse's dust. He rode fast, moving underneath the watchtower that sat above the road into the fort, and then veered west toward the corrals. Millard watched Newton Ahalo Mantubby ride past the baker's oven and the guardhouse and dismount in front of the corral, already full of horses. The wagon drew closer to the watchtower. He could see Steve Locksberg in the center window.
Won't be long now.
Yeah, you're right. It won't be long. Won't be long at all.
Hey!
Red leaned over to look from his side, and Millard peered around the canvas flap on his side. Zane Maxwell had his horse at a gallop, leaning forward, low in the saddle. Millard saw dust down the road to the south.
Hurry! Get moving, Red! They're coming! Those Texans are coming! Hurry!
Maxwell rode past the wagon, looking up at Locksberg up in the log cabin on the stone pillar.
Get moving, man!
McCoy caught up with the wagon, riding alongside, gripping the pistol grip shotgun. Red grabbed a whip, aiming the black snake above the mule's long ears.
Yeah! Yeah, damn you!
The Winchester 3220 bounced on his lap.
Turn to place!
McCoy spurred his horse forward.
They ain't supposed to be here for another hour or more!
Again, Millard leaned over the side of the wagon. He could make out the stagecoach pulled by a team of 6 black horses in the near distance. Millard surreptitiously pulled out a match he'd hidden in his pocket.
Yeah! Yeah!
The watchtower was closer. Millard glanced through the oval canvas opening at the kegs in the back. He struck the match on the buckboard and pitched it into the back.
What the?
Millard snatched the rifle from the gunman's lap, kicked up, and jumped. He landed hard to the side of the road, kept the Winchester in his arms as he rolled over and fell into a ditch. Millard rolled over and came up. The detonation deafened him. Even a foot down in the dry ditch, an intense heat singed his shirt. Smoke and dust obscured his vision. He stepped into the smoke, waving his arms at the approaching stagecoach.
Go back! Get up!
out of here!
To his amazement, the long-haired driver of the stagecoach didn't slow or even try to stop his team. He steered the vehicle off the road, moving around the destroyed main gate. The coach bounced, almost toppled over, but somehow managed to regain all four wheels as it clipped the fence that ran about 25 yards alongside the gate. As the stagecoach disappeared into the smoke, all Millard could see was the ruins of the covered wagon and the burning tower. McCoy and Maxwell had made the mistake of leaving the making of the whiskey and the loading of the wagon to Millard, James, and Robin. Oh, they had brewed some whiskey, but the only poison in it was castor oil. Millard had packed the gunpowder into one keg and spread a mass of black powder right beside it. That's what the match had touched off. That keg had exploded, igniting the whiskey barrels and sending poor Red, and unfortunately the team of mules and his trailing horse, into oblivion. It had exploded just as Millard had hoped, right as it passed the tower, which was now aflame. But it had not killed Steve Locksberg up in the tower. Millard hurried toward the scorching hot remains of the covered wagon and aimed his Winchester at the floor of the tower. Millard went around to the other side, looking up at the open windows, and aimed at the center window. 3 seconds later, Steve Locksberg jumped down through the trapdoor, holding a Colt Lightning in each hand. Millard knew that was a fool's play. You didn't win gunfights being the fastest. You won them being accurate. Locksberg was driven into the conflagration behind him. He stepped away from the fiery mass and fell face down onto the hot ground, his shirt ablaze. Millard went over and kicked dirt onto the dead killer's shirt until the body was just smoking. He also picked up both double-action revolvers, sticking the hot weapons into his waistband, ignoring the pain, and moved away from the burning mass. At the flagpole, six persons had managed to stop the stagecoach team and slam the lever to set the brake. He dropped into the driver's box.
Stay down! Stay down! Stay down!
A bullet from the big stone barracks off to the west had clipped the makeshift pole from which the Texas flag waved. Six persons came up with the Winchester scatter gun. He leaped from the coach onto the ground and ran toward the stone building. A figure with a black mustache appeared in the corner upstairs window. The Cherokee's buckshot struck just to the left of the window. 10 steps later, six persons was inside the barracks, finding the stairs and taking them two at a time. Something inside him told him to stop. Six persons went stealthily back down the steps and moved towards the door. The man with the black mustache and a pair of old Remington revolvers in both hands appeared in the doorway. One bullet went far to the left of six persons. The other tugged at the brim of his hat. The Cherokee lawman moved, fishing 2 5/8-inch shells from his pocket to reload the 87 as he reached the doorway. He looked outside to see the man with the black mustache lying face up, spread-eagled, quite dead on the ground. Tulip Bells came bolting down the stairs that led to the veranda of the bigger barracks on the south side of the parade ground and ran straight for the stagecoach. McCoy, who had dropped from the saddle behind the old log cabin on the other side of the road, started running toward it too. But Bells reached it first, grabbed the latch to the door, and swung the door open. As McCoy stopped running, he saw that boy who'd helped Bodine leap outside of the stagecoach, levering the big Winchester 50 caliber 100-450 rifle. The other door opened, and that other kid stepped out, holding a Star revolver in each hand. A chunk of lead tore a hole through the side of McCoy's linen duster just as his partner was riding toward him, pulling a black horse behind him.
That's all going to hell! Let's ride! We gotta get out of here!
Maxwell didn't even slow down, but did drop the reins to the black as his horse galloped past, heading straight toward the smoke. McCoy snatched the reins and leaped into the saddle. Another bullet whizzed over his head. McCoy gouged the horse's sides with his spurs, leaned low in the saddle, and rode as hard as he could, desperately trying to get away. James Mann knew he had missed as McCoy vanished in the smoke and dust following Zane Maxwell. He looked around, saw Robin Gillette coming from behind the coach, holding those double-action revolvers in her hands. He saw the Cherokee lawman hurrying across the grounds from a big stone building.
James!
Finally, he saw his father crossing the road from the south side of the post.
I'm all right, Pa!
James started running as fast as he could, gathering the reins to the horse trying to break the tethers holding it to the railing of the stairs in front of the long wooden building.
I'm going after McCoy and Maxwell!
No!
James mounted and started pounding the horse's side with the hot barrel of the Winchester 86, riding into the smoke. Jackson's six persons stopped underneath the flagpole.
Shit!
As that fool-headed boy rode out of the fort, he swung his shotgun toward the man running toward them, but quickly lowered it.
Miller!
OCO, Jackson.
Seal, you all right, girl?
Yeah.
Another figure came trotting a horse and bringing two saddled mounts behind him. Newton, a hollow man Tubby, reined to a stop.
Got these from the corral, Jack.
Don't call me Jack.
Six persons gathered the reins to the sorrel and swung into the saddle. Beside him, Millard mounted the gray.
What about me?
You stay put.
You want to ride with us?
Are you crazy?
Near the Chickasaw-Choctaw border, James Mann could see the dust kicked up by Link McCoy and Zane Maxwell's horses up ahead of him. About 5 miles from the fort, his father and Jackson's six persons caught up with him.
What do you think you're doing?
The same as you're doing! And him!
We'll need him!
He's just a kid!
We still need him!
They came to the lightly timbered hills and slowed their animals to a walk, no longer seeing dust. Two rifles and the Cherokee shotgun were at the ready.
Cave country, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Their mounts have to be as played out as our own.
Mm-hmm.
You circle around. Leave James here to cover the rear. I'll ride the trail.
McCoy, or Maxwell, or likely both, had dismounted on the far side of the hills, left their rundown horses, and come back around to set up an ambush.
No, you circle around. I'll ride the trail.
Why?
Because I'm the only one of you with a badge.
The eyeglasses glinted as the Cherokee looked directly at James.
Well, the only one with a commission.
Millard rode his horse off to the west, moving deeper through the trees, making a wide berth.
Dismount, James. You got a good view from right here.
James dismounted, ground reining the horse. He lay on his stomach, Winchester against his shoulder, and stared up the hill, barren of just about everything except a few rocks too small for anyone to take shelter behind.
It's harder to shoot uphill, so just aim low. Always aim low.
Six persons kneed his pinto's sides. As the horse carried him up the hill, James saw two figures materialize, springing from the earth on opposite ends of the trail like demons rising from Hades. Six persons dove off as the lawman's horse fell to its side. Both men turned and ran toward him to finish the job. James charged forward. A bullet ricocheted off a rock in front of McCoy's feet, and James knew that his father was shooting from his position up the hill. His father had McCoy covered, leading Maxwell to James. James sprinted in that direction. He could make out six persons crawling for his Winchester 87, his leg bleeding from several buckshot from McCoy's scatter gun. Maxwell ran too. Both headed straight for the Cherokee. Maxwell slid to a stop, saw James, and brought the revolver up. James had shot the weapon empty. Yet he did not stop charging. He shifted the weapon, grabbed the barrel, still running, as Maxwell's finger tightened on the trigger, and swung it as hard as he could. James hit the ground and came up dazed. The bullet had scorched his side, but that was it. His Winchester was on the ground beside the body of Zane Maxwell, whose skull had been crushed by the heavy rifle. James turned, saw the smoke from his father's rifle in the woods, saw McCoy dropping back into a hole. Grabbing six-person shotgun, James ran after the outlaw, following him straight into that hole.
Go!
The ground was slick, hard, cold. James slid down and dived to his left. Carefully, he peeked around the corner. The passageway seemed narrow, but not too long. He couldn't tell if there were any side tunnels or side rooms, any place McCoy could be hiding. It wasn't as dark as he had expected it to be. In fact, he could see pretty well. Keeping the shotgun's barrel pointed directly down the cave, he took a step into the open, paused, and took another step, his finger tight on the Winchester's trigger. He had to step over some rocks and duck his head. His eyes focused on what lay ahead, just dark earth. 10 more yards and he stopped, leaning into a small depression in the cave's wall. He had come to the entrance of a larger room. Beyond it, he saw another tunnel and light shining from the end where Maxwell had jumped up from. Likely, McCoy hid in there somewhere, but on which side? Left? Right? Or was he waiting in the tunnel on the far side of the room? He fought down the panic and the bile rising in his throat. Just when he felt he would collapse in total fear, a certain calm overcame him, and he thought with complete and total clarity, remembering what his father had told him when he'd first, almost the only time, he'd taken him hunting.
Patience. Be patient. Make sure what you're shooting at before you squeeze that trigger. This isn't a race. You race, you lose.
It was not James who had to get out of the cave. It was McCoy. McCoy had to get out of that cave soon before other posses caught up with him. James could wait, but McCoy could not get out of the cave without showing his face. Smiling, James moved to the center of the tunnel and sat down. He did, of course, keep the barrel of Six Persons 12 gauge aimed at the opening as he waited for Link McCoy. James lost all track of time. 10 minutes? An hour? 5 hours? He wasn't sure. It didn't matter. He just sat there, holding the shotgun, which never seemed heavy. He never felt tired. He kept quiet, kept listening, and just waited. James wasn't scared. He tightened the shotgun's butt against his shoulder and got ready to dive to his right. McCoy came from James's left, sending chopped up bits of razor splattering off the cave's wall. James had been smart to sit in the center. James saw the gunman hurled against the wall. James slid through the opening to the large room. His foot hit something, McCoy's shotgun. James brought his weapon up, drew a bead on the outlaw, but relaxed his finger on the trigger. The killer had pulled himself up and was crawling through the opening. James calmly walked across the room. He watched McCoy clawing his way up the exit into the sunlight. James stopped to pick up the outlaw's shotgun and ducked as he went into the tunnel. He followed the bloody trail the thief was leaving. He stuck the barrel of McCoy's shotgun through the opening, tossed it onto the ground, then pushed Six Persons' Winchester into the fresh air and laid it down gently. His arms came through. He looked at the clear blue sky and felt himself being lifted out of the cave and onto the top of the hill.
Hello, Pa.
His father answered by squeezing him into a bear hug. Then his dad stepped back but put an arm around James's shoulders. Jackson Six Persons, hobbling on a piece of wood as a crutch, one leg wrapped with bloody white strips of bandages, stood over the body of Link McCoy, who would rob no more banks, trains, Texans, or Chickasaws. Father and son joined the deputy marshal.
Jackson? How in the same hell did you get that stagecoach?
Fort Smith.
Well, sir, Robin Gillette, James Mann, and I had been riding north toward Fort Washita when we saw the Texans traveling hard in that stagecoach. We dismounted, and I stood in the center of the road with my shotgun pointed down and held loosely in my left hand. My right hand gripped the six-point star, which I held out and over my head to let the stagecoach driver know that I was a lawman. The driver and the two guards with double-barreled Parkers were sitting atop the coach when it stopped. I explained what was waiting for them at Fort Washita and suggested that they leave the gold, which was already in a Wells Fargo box inside the coach next to the buckets of whiskey and beer, and that the guards ride with me and surprise the McCoy Maxwell gang. The leader of the Texas cattlemen, a man named Willoughby, proclaimed that no Injun was gonna suggest anything to him. But I managed to convince everyone that I was a federal marshal. However, none of the guards or cattlemen were willing to go with me, so they stayed at the side of the road to protect the box of gold. So I crawled up onto the driver's box and drove the stagecoach to Fort Washita.
Amazing. And what of the money from the bank robbery in Greenville?
Never found it.
Probably spent it.
Jackson Six Persons had his doubts. He had telegraphed the sheriff in Greenville, asking about that teller, Mike Crawford, the one who had lost his watch, now in the hands of Newton, a hollow man Tubby, the one whom bank president Grover Cleveland had sent to check on that zebra dun that had trotted back to town after the holdup, the same one the bank president had fired, even though Crawford had identified Link McCoy. Sheriff Whit Marion had replied that Crawford and his family had left town. No one knew where they had gone, although someone seemed to have overheard Crawford mentioning Mexico. The bank had reported a loss of $1,793.67. The gang had allegedly made off with $400. Six Persons figured $1,393.67 would replace a gold watch with plenty of money to spare, but he only shrugged at the marshal's theory.
Amazing. And you killed McCoy, Maxwell, and Bells?
Big reward for you, Six Persons.
Mm-mm. For him.
Six Persons pointed to James, who sat uncomfortably in a comfortable leather couch.
James got all of them. Saved my hide doing it, too.
Bully for you, kid. There's a lot of money.
I'd rather have something else.
James reached into his pocket and pulled out his uncle's badge.
What?
My late uncle's job.
The judge and marshal looked at one another, at six persons, and finally at James Mann.
Son, federal deputy marshals die often, far too often in the Indian Territory. You should...
I want that job, sir.
Are you 21 years of age, son?
Millard Mann. It's been a long, long time.
That's right, Your Honor. Sorry to barge in on you. It's no bother at all, man. Your son here wants to be a lawman, one of my deputies. I just asked him if he was 21, but maybe you can answer that for us.
Millard looked at James, at six persons, and finally at Judge Parker. At last, his gaze landed on Marshal Crump, and his posture relaxed. He even smiled and looked back to his son before answering.
Well, George, I reckon I'll always look at James as a 10-year-old, sometimes younger. Guess that's how I'll see him when he's bringing my grandbaby so I can bounce him on my knee. But he's all grown up, George. Time Libby and I face that. Is he 21? He's a man. Surely a man. A man full grown.
Three men, Jackson six persons, Millard Mann, and James Mann, stood on the platform. Pinned to his new vest, the latter's badge reflected the sunlight. Robin's mother had divorced that drunken fool and was remarried to a sober, pleasant store owner. The marshals had tracked them down, pooled to buy the girl a ticket, and sent her home.
The girl get off all right?
Yes, sir. Back to her home in Lincoln, Nebraska.
You see her off, son? She'll do fine in Nebraska.
And it ain't too far away from Fort Smith.
All aboard!
Millard picked up his grip and the scabbard carrying his Winchester 1 of 1,000.
Now, you'll write your mother once a week. Let us know how you're doing, what you're doing. And you'll listen to this ornery old man with bad eyes and do exactly as he tells you. His Cherokee might not look like much, but he'll keep you alive. I'm proud of you, son.
I'm proud of you, Paul.
All aboard!
Miller took the rifle and hurried to the nearest car. James and six persons watched him go. They stayed on the platform, watching the train pull out of the station.
Let's go.
They walked until they reached a saloon at Garrison Avenue. The sign above the batwing doors said, Texas Corner Saloon.
This is where the deputy marshals gather.
We going to have a drink?
No, no. Katie Crockett runs it. She's not much older than you. Now, we just came here to pick up your horse. I had Flat bring it down.
Six persons pointed to a brown gelding tied to a hitching post. James saw the saddle and the Winchester 86 in the scabbard. But it was the horse that he ran to. He rubbed its neck and turned toward Jackson's six persons.
This is old Buck, Uncle Jimmy's. But...
Listen. Crump pays you what some folks might call a salary, but most would call a pittance. U.S. Marshal does not provide in any way or form clothes, lodging, firearms, weapons, or grub. It will pay for mileage if it's on official duty, and some minor expenses.
Six persons pointed to the upstairs of the saloon.
Katie will give a lawman a room. Cheap, noisy, not too comfortable. You understand this, James. That's all Katie's given.
But this...
Jimmy left it with me when he... Well, I figured old Buck belongs to you now.
Thanks, Jackson.
Don't thank me. You just remember what you got told in the judge's chambers the other day. Marshals get killed out here. A lot. You remember that. If you ever pull some fool stunt like you did when you jumped into that cave to get Link McCoy, I might just kill you myself.
James's grin widened until the old man reached into his pocket and pulled out some papers.
What are those?
Shh. Hell. Arrest warrant, you dumb oaf.
Six persons swung into his saddle.
Boy, you got a lot of learning to do. Mount up.
James grabbed the rein, swung into the saddle, and packed old Buck onto the street.
You ever been in the Winding Steer Mountains?
No, sir.
We'll meet Flat and Mallory and another. Riley Monaco is his name. He's about as worthless as the other two combined, across the river. Try not to get yourself killed before you write your first letter to your ma, huh? And your pa would never let me hear the end of it.
They rode down Garrison Avenue, a sight that would soon become familiar to the residents of Fort Smith, Arkansas. The long-haired old Indian on a paint horse carrying a Winchester Model 1887 lever-action 12-gauge shotgun, and a younger deputy named James Mann riding a brown gelding and armed with a Winchester Model 1886 rifle in .50-100-450 caliber. Winchester 1887 is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2015, J.A. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2017, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. Performed by Ken Jackson, Richard Rowan, Drew Copus, Mort Shelby, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Bradley Smith, Michael John Casey, Colleen Delaney, Lawrence Redmond, Tom Simpson, Bruce Allen Rauscher, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Gary Tells, Jeff Allen, Alejandro Ruiz, Christopher Walker, Jonathan Church, Christopher Davenport, Danny Stoller, Kimberly Gilbert, Eric Singdalson, Nanette Savard. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Winchester 1887 theme music by John Glennon. Book adapted for graphic audio by Doug Krenzlin. If you enjoyed Winchester 1887, look for Those Jensen Boys, 12 Dead Men, and the series Lou Profit Bounty Hunter. Available at road stops everywhere. At 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other exciting graphic audio titles.
You been like this all your life, Lou?
How's that?
Living for fun and money?
Well, I was in the war, Katie. War butternut gray. No. After that, I made a pact with the devil. I told him that if he showed me one hell of a good time for the rest of the life I had left, I'd shovel all the coal he wanted down the lode.
The devil and Lou Profit on the same side. Lord help us all.
Profit, huh? I want him dead.
Then he's dead, Billy.
Who are you anyway, Profit?
I'm a bounty hunter.
What the hell are you up to?
About 6'3". See you, Sheriff.
Not if I see you first, Prophet.
Lou!
Hello, Miss Angie.
Don't Miss Angie me, Lou Prophet. You're in town and you haven't come to see me.
Oh, I'll be back, Miss Angie. Ah! Don't you worry. I'll be back soon.
Just what in the hell do you think you're doing?
I gotta be nuts.
You're crazy, Prophet.
Lady, I may not have a whole lot of proper schooling, but I've been on the Owl Hoot Trail long enough to know when a man with a big gun's dogging me, and one's dogging me now. Bank on it.
Why, you moron, you... Oh! I've never shot a man before.
Could have fooled me.
Mr. Prophet, you are an ill-mannered man.
A reprobate.
Oh, an unguarded lady is unsafe in your company.
From Peter Brandvold, author of 45 Caliber.
Prophet! Yee-haw!
Prophet?
Prophet!
Graphic Audio presents...
$500, dead or alive. Dead, I guess.
Lou Prophet, Bounty Hunter.
Will Tanner was raised to be a rancher, with a good eye for horses and a fast gun hand.
You're just looking for trouble, boss.
Shorty's right. He's got a mean streak in him.
Too late. Already on him. Let him go, Shorty.
Is he dead?
Uh-huh.
My lord. What do you want me to do about that horse? Want me to pull the saddle off?
No. You go find Cal and Slim and a couple of shovels. I'll take care of the horse.
That damn horse is a man-killer.
I'm afraid you're right.
Holding the bridle, he forced the roan's head down so we could look him in the eye.
Go back to hell where you came from. You killed a good man today.
But the death of surrogate father Jim Hightower puts him on the road to clear his head and find his fortune.
Won't you be needed here at the ranch?
No, ma'am. Not really. Shorty and the others can handle everything here. There aren't but a handful of cattle left to worry about, and the horses. They don't need me.
Fate has a different future in mind for the young ranch hand.
You'd be Luther Gamble, I reckon.
Never mind who I am, you son of a bitch. I know who you are. And that's a piece of bad luck for you. It's eye for an eye. You might have brought my boy in to hang, but by God, you're gonna go with him.
That don't make a lot of sense when you've got all these guns aiming right at you and your boys.
What guns? There ain't nobody but you, and I'm tired of hearing you talk.
Maybe you better listen to what he's telling you.
What?
You all right, partner? I was in a tight spot there, and I doubt I could have got out of it without at least one of them putting a bullet in me. Are you one of the deputies from up Kansas way?
No, I ain't no deputy. I just came in to get a drink and some supper.
You consider working for the U.S. Marshal Service?
Shoot, no.
Why not? I wouldn't have even mentioned it to you, but I ain't ever seen a man with better makings for a deputy marshal than you. Do me and yourself a favor, and think about it. The Marshal Service needs men that think fast and ain't scared when bullets are flying.
Helping an outgunned lawman sets Will on a new trail.
If I hire you, you'll be working almost all the time in Indian Territory. And that's not a particularly healthy country for deputy marshals. Bride can tell you that if he hasn't already. How well do you know that country?
Some.
Well, I expect you'll get to know it better if you last long enough. I'll tell Judge Parker I've hired you, and he'll officially commission you as a U.S. Deputy Marshal. So I'll just say welcome to the service. I hope it suits you, and you suit the service.
The job is a simple one. Catch lawbreakers by whatever means necessary and bring them to Judge Parker's court to be tried. In the wide and wild Oklahoma Indian Territory, his authority will be unlimited. But equally limitless will be the dangers he faces.
And may God have mercy on your soul.
William W. Johnstone's Will Tanner, U.S. Deputy Marshal, Book 1, now in graphic audio.
Thanks for listening to this graphic audio production.
Graphic Audio has over 1,000 titles and 100 series to choose from in high-quality download formats. If you'd like to listen to an entire series, you can now conveniently purchase a download series set from GraphicAudio.net. At GraphicAudio.net, you can also earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable towards future online purchases. You can stream or get full downloads directly to your mobile phone or tablet with our newly updated Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices. Listen to a movie in your mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. And be sure to listen to our new free Graphic Audio Story Podcast, GASP, featuring all new serialized episodes of a complete full-length story, along with episodes that feature short stories in our graphic audio format. Once you do, we're confident you'll want to subscribe, give us a 5-star review, and recommend us to your friends and family. You can subscribe to GASP through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, and RSS feeds. Coming this fall, look for Graphic Audio Streams, our new streaming subscription service. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net.